Scary dreams kept me up most of the night. In the morning, I had no appetite for breakfast. I just kept looking at the empty rooms of the princess and prof and the ominous birdcage. Shortly before noon, I opened the door to greet Legs Diamond. He politely said that AR had asked him to stop by on his way back to New York from Cape May. He'd come bearing good news. All charges against me had been dropped. Although a puny guy with droopy eyes and big ears, he was strangely handsome. Fidgeting with the keys to his car and moving his neck around as if his tie were too tight, he made me think of an unsheathed electrical wire. Everything about him seemed to crackle. After I thanked Legs for the news, a light bulb went on in my head. Not wishing to tip my hand, I nonchalantly replied, "Cape May. Never been. I suppose AR is running booze out of there. Nice place. Pretty beaches. Good for smuggling. For a kid, you're in the know." Growing more relaxed, Legs grew more effusive. During the course of the evening, I learned that he relished his role as AR's most dependable collector, bragging about pistol whipping or shooting deadbeats or intimidating backsliders. "There's a guy used to work for us, a little sheeny." He caught himself. "I don't mean nothing by it. After all, AR and me, we're partners, you might say." Fortunately, Legs and I were alone, otherwise his language would have earned him the old heave-ho. "Well, anyway, this guy used to work for us. Now he's hooked up with some other people. AR don't like competition, so he told me to pay him a visit." My attention now wholly arrested, I coaxed Legs to give me further details. "He pays some sailor in the Coast Guard to tell him which days and times it's safe to bring in the booze. Then the Yid passes along the info on a sandwich board down at the beach. Speedboats come in close enough to read the numbers through their binocs and know when to land the stuff. Clever little Yid. Pray tell, what can he put on the board? You can't go around saying, 'Bring in the whiskey at 2 in the morning. Well, let's say he's selling silk slips, which in fact he does. He also sells flags, banners, and bunting. But anyway, the board reads, silk slips, $2.49, Monday. That tells us to land the stuff on Monday precisely 2:49 a.m. He's got a place called Petticoat Lane, right? Yeah, a plush joint with fancy mirrors and rugs around the corner from the Chalfont Hotel. But how do you know? I did business with him in New York. He's a pipsqueak." Having said that, I could hardly ask the man's name. However, I no longer had any need to. "New York," said Legs. "I can't get back fast enough. Except maybe for Albany. There ain't nothing like it." I'd never been to the state capital, but I couldn't imagine how it could compare with the white lights of Manhattan. Just thinking about the shows and the vaudes and the museums and the movies made me long for the city. Mom insisted that Legs stay for dinner after I told her that AR had sent him with the news that Fallon had gotten me off. To celebrate, I asked Mom to sing one of my favorite Yiddish songs. In happier times, she'd embellish it with a quaint little jig. But no sooner had I made my request than I realized her embarrassment. Sung to the tune of Ta-ra Boom-die, the song was called the Schneiderman Song. Mom blushed, but Mr. Schneiderman jovially laughed and begged for a demonstration. Reluctantly moving to the center of the dining room, she slowly began to dance and in a thin but steady voice sang, "Vier seien schöne Mädeli, we are pretty little girls. Vier tragen kurze Kädeli, we wear pretty little dresses. Vier tragen schich und säckerlack, we wear shoes and stockings. Vier farben doch die Bäckerlach, we rouge our cheeks." As Mom inhaled and readied herself for the second verse, I leapt ahead and silently translated, knowing the embarrassment she'd feel at the end. "I won't wed a doctor, I won't wed a sailor, I won't wed a farmer, but rather a tailor, a Schneiderman." When she'd finished, nobody spoke. Mr. Schneidemann, his face wet with tears, had a faraway look. I ducked into the kitchen, blew my nose a good blast, and made tea for the guests. Later that evening, Legs left. The next day, Ben rattled up to the house in an old Model T borrowed from a friend. I said goodbye to Mom and the others and set out with Ben for a baseball game. I'd agreed to play right field in a game between Norma and Carmel. In sandlot baseball, since most hitters are righties who usually hit flies into left, you put your worst player in right. 5 or 6 times a summer, the two towns locked horns on the grass field behind the one-room Carmel schoolhouse, where they fiercely contested every hit, run, and out. Unlike our rag team of pickup players, Norma had a regular 9 who passionately believed baseball was more than the national game, it was a religion. They normally beat the tar out of us. Their pitchers played chin music with our batters, trying to bully us by occasionally aiming at our chins. Ben and I had often played catch with 2 old fielder's gloves that belonged in a museum. Most girls don't know how to throw a ball, they kind of push it. But I knew how to wind up and sling the old apple. I also knew how to judge a fly ball, as Ben discovered when he skied a few and I positioned myself just right to catch him. Persuaded that I was as good as some of the rummies who'd played for Carmel before, he asked me to take part. My only trouble with baseball is that the short periods of action are followed by long spells of boredom, so I can never keep my mind on the game. Most games are so dull that I'd rather be watching a spelling bee. Frankly, I can't understand why the clergy want to ban baseball on Sundays. After you see one guy whiff, a second pop out, a third walk, and a fourth ground out, a rousing sermon seems truckloads more fun. Play began at 3:30. By the 7th inning, we were behind 4-2, and the only balls that had come my way were grounders that had passed through the infield and presented no problem. I just scooped them up and made the relay to second base. The top of the 8th, Norma put 2 men on base in scoring position at 2nd and 3rd with 1 away. The next batter hit a lazy fly to short right. The can of corn seemed to hang for hours, giving me time to get underneath. As I looked up, I saw not only the ball outlined against the blue sky, but also a street scene. Amid rumbling traffic, some East Side kids were in wild abandon because one of them, standing over an iron manhole cover for home plate, had lifted a fly over the outfielder's head. Dashing from the first sewer grating to the second, the batter darted among clanging trolley cars to reach all the bases, while the fielder chased the ball under the noses of draft horses. For love of the game, those kids risked their lives. They, more so than I, deserved this playing field, where I reached toward the sun and trapped in my mitt the easy fly ball. The man on 3rd, thinking he'd have no trouble scoring with a girl in right field, broke for the plate. I uncorked a throw that nailed him 3 feet from home. In the bottom of the 8th, we scored 1 run to make it 4-3. In the last of the 9th, we had a man on 3rd with only 1 out. It was my turn at bat. I'd already struck out 3 times in a row. Ben wanted me to swing away, but I suggested a bunt to squeeze home the runner. Squaring off at the plate, I met the ball out in front. But instead of it rolling down the first baseline as I intended, it took off for a bloop single over 2nd, scoring the runner. The game now tied, the next batter hit a ground ball to short, forcing me out at 2nd. The throw to 1st for the double play was too late. With a runner at 1st and Jack Skilowitz, our leadoff batter, at the plate, I just felt that here was our chance. Jack had sculpted arms and the strength of a weightlifter. The first pitch he fouled off over the schoolhouse. The 2nd was a ball. They say 3 is a charm. Well, the 3rd pitch he lifted clear into the woods. The center fielder is probably still looking for the ball to this day. We won the game 5-4. That night, never happier, Ben and I made love. I knew we would. Wanting to feel loved in a physical way, to give and receive, I believed going all the way would be a beautiful sharing. When I let Ben touch me above the waist, I felt a little guilty. and really guilty when I let him cross the magic line below the waist. Had I not been so excited and intoxicated by my own recklessness, I would have waited. At the very least, I should have insisted he use something, but was afraid it would sound like I knew all about sex. Though Mom never said anything specific, I understood exactly what was acceptable to her and what wasn't. You had to be married to have sex. The girls at school had said that the worst thing you could do was plan on it, because that meant you knew you were going to do it and you didn't try to stop yourself. It was July 8, my 17th birthday. The next day proved fateful. A.R. rang the farmhouse to say that Miseria was on the warpath. He discovered that one of the jewels was glass. Miseria swore that unless it turned up, I was mincemeat. A.R. said I had to return to New York, his turf, where he could guarantee my safety. In the country, I was a sitting duck. At first, I thought it was one of his tricks, a way to get me into his clutches. But when he said, "Listen, kid, I don't want your death on my head," I chose not to gamble. "I've got to leave," I told Ben, explaining the danger I was in. When he said he wanted to share it with me, I adamantly refused and told him that he wasn't to whisper a word to my mom. "I'll be back for the hayrides and the horseshoes and the wrestling." "Your absence is gonna kill her, you know," said Ben. "No, it's not." "Well, it's gonna kill me." I squeezed his hand. As he walked away, I cried bitterly, for him and for me. Ours had been a quiet engagement of two caring people. We shared more in silence than in words, literally growing in each other's eyes. Some things, as the poet says, we hold apart, like certain matters of the heart. But in everything else, we made ourselves vulnerable to the other. Ben was the first man who didn't look through me. To him, I was actually visible. And he must have seen something he liked, because he wasn't put off by my blemishes. In his company, I never felt the need to pretend to be what I wasn't. My fears of being ugly and stupid disappeared. He made me feel attractive and praised my ideas. Like Mom and Pop, he took pleasure in my silly humor and didn't think I was a squirt. I suppose that's why I gave myself to him, carelessly, I admit, but also wonderfully. If the test of loving another human being is how much we enable that person to change for the better, then Ben won the golden ring. He kissed Henny the Frog, and Henrietta the young woman was born. At breakfast, I found a letter waiting for me. According to Mr. Schneiderman, who'd wakened at 4, Ben had dropped it off before dawn. To this day, I treasure his words. "Dear Henny, since it is too painful for me to mention your leaving, I write of only fond memories. If you hold remembrance, dear, I know you'll never forget our pitching horseshoes on golden mornings when the grass was wet with dew, and our wrestling in the tall grass which would turn brittle in the afternoon sun and scratch our behinds. God, weren't those the timeless days? And I know you'll never forget how we worked side by side in the fields, churning up a great sweat, and how we cut across Naravlansky's tomato fields into the birch and cedar fringing the woods, swinging our arms and jumping round like wild Indians to keep off the mosquitoes, as we made our way down the old Indian trails through the pines and the wild laurel to Morris River. Cripes, that water was sweet and cold. We would drink right from the river, except maybe when the dye company was coloring nurses' uniforms, and then we'd come out looking like Indians, blue all over. The arrowheads, Henny. I know you'll always remember the arrowheads. We'd find them along the trails and wonder what brought the Indians to live in these woods. God, Henny, those were hours crowded with glorious life. I'll never forget them, or you. Love, Ben.